This is the Improve Photography Podcast, episode number 86. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improve Photography Podcast. I am Jim Harmer, and I'm joined as always by Darren Meller. Darren has been out shooting landscapes for the last week, and so he's really ready for a good dose of photography knowledge to dump on your head. Welcome to the show, Darren.
Hey, Jim, it's good to be back from a 1,600-mile journey just to get some amazing shots.
Yeah, so tell me about it. You were at home in Glenwood, Iowa, and all of a sudden you texted me and you're like, I'm in Colorado. What happened?
Well, Saturday morning I woke up and I thought, well, I need to toss together a bag and I want to head out somewhere, and I posted it on Facebook on my business page and my main page. I said, well, where should I head? Should I head up to Canada? And I live south of Winnipeg, which would have been about 12 hours of driving. And I said, Minneapolis. And I talked to a friend and he said, the Leafs aren't really ready there. And then I said, where in Colorado have I not been? And I've been to Estes. I've been down south towards Durango, Telluride, Vail, everywhere else. And I said, I've never been to Aspen. And I heard it's really beautiful this time of the year. And put together a plan and asked my dad, and I said, do you want to come? And he said, nah, I really don't have the time because I have a consulting thing. And I had my mom tag along, and next thing we knew, we drove out to Denver that first day on Sunday morning, spent the night in Denver, got up real early and drove to Aspen, and even stuck it out when it was raining on us, but it was beautiful. It was just one of those situations where you woke up every morning and you just had this big old grin on your face and you said, my gosh, will you stop being beautiful?
Well, that's awesome. Well, I'm really excited to start shooting fall color. Was in the United States, at least, we're getting lots of fall color now. In the rest of the world, it may be spring and on the other side. But are you seeing a lot of color already? Did you see it in Colorado, or were you a little bit too early?
I think I was spot on for Aspen. I have a friend who's heading out to Glenwood Springs, which is roughly in the area. And there, it's amazing when you're going through the different passes through there. There's certain areas where all the aspens are still green. And then there's other areas where I was in Aspen where they're yellowish orange and they're already falling off the leaves. Like the park rangers told me, they said, I would hate to come next week because the winds are coming through. They've already had some snow come down and leaves are all over the ground. So I think that I hit it on the perfect time. Everybody told me when I was there, it was peak. So it just turned out so well. The color varieties from the green pines to the yellow aspens to the snow-kissed mountains, it just created so dynamic photos. I just was so impressed. I just kept walking around smiling and trying to figure out how I wanted to compose the shot in my head. And I was overwhelmed. You just had to press pause on your brain for a little bit and just take it in and then start thinking photography.
Well, that's awesome. I'm excited to get out and shoot some fall color as well. I have two trips planned. One, I'm headed to Portland in 2 weeks, and I'm hoping I'll be able to meet up with some of the readers of the website, listeners of the podcast that live in Portland, but it's going to be a short shoot, so maybe just for an evening or something. And then I'm coming home, and I'm going to shoot a gold medalist in swimming. I'm doing a sports photography shoot. That is so cool. I'm really excited about that one. Did I tell you the story about that? I keep feeling like I have deja vu, like I already talked about this.
I think you've told a story where you used a beauty dish with swimming, and you weren't really satisfied with how the beauty dish worked. Is that the same situation?
No, I was... So a friend of a friend called and said, hey, I know somebody who needs engagement photos, but they don't have any money. And of course, all photographers are like, yay, pick me, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a friend who was calling. And so I thought, whatever, I'll take care of him. And so I didn't, you know, turn it away right away. And so I talked to the person, and I said, and they said, you know, really don't want to spend very much money, but we really need engagement photos, and we're also getting married in the spring, and we need a wedding photographer too. And I thought, oh great, you know, somebody wants free wedding photos. But you know, I don't know, I'm always trying to help people, especially if they just don't have the money. So I talked to him, and he said, oh yeah, and by the way, my wife is a gold medalist in swimming from the 2012 Olympics. And I was like, what?
What an opportunity.
So I was like, I have a deal for you. If you'll, I'll shoot your engagement shoot for free, but let's schedule a sports photography shoot. And that will be awesome for building my portfolio. I've mentioned on the podcast that I've been working on that. So I have that shoot coming up. And it goes to show you, you just can't give anything away. We've been talking a lot on the podcast about just being nice and being helpful and finding ways to give back. And it, what goes around always comes back to you. And so, you know, find ways to just get out and shoot. It's better to get your camera out and shoot something than to just leave it in the closet and hope you have a paying client. I'm not saying everybody should work for free. You shouldn't. You should be paid for your work. But I am saying that there are often some pretty cool opportunities if you won't turn things away right away and you try to find solutions that work. Anyway, so I'm shooting that. And then after that, I'm headed to West Virginia, to Babcock State Park. What I've been doing is I just look on Pixoto and 500px and Flickr and check what were the most popular photos from 11 months ago. And it's cool when I do that because then you see what cool things are going on in the world next month. You know, it may be, you know, fall colors can be cool, and so then I'll plan a trip to go do that, or an event, like there's a lighthouse in California that they just turn on the light one time a year, and it's just incredible, and photographers line up everywhere. So, you know, lots of things like that that I want to know about as they're coming up. So yeah, I looked at that, and I found just a photo that frankly wasn't very good of Babcock State Park in West Virginia. But the location was gorgeous. I mean, it's unbelievable, this beautiful grist mill and the little stream coming down and fall color everywhere. And I saw that photo. I said, I am going there. So I planned a trip there. And some of you will be joining me. I started a group on the travel group. I posted about that. And if you're not on the travel group, we're having a big problem with spam. That's why we aren't adding a lot of people to it. So for the time being, what I'm going to do is every time there's a group going out, I'm just going to announce it here on the podcast, and we'll put it in the show notes as well. And then we're creating little Facebook groups for each one. So I created a little group for the Babcock State Park. And so if you are around there in West Virginia, or, you know, it's only like 4 hours from Pittsburgh and a couple other states kind of in the middle there. So check it out and come shoot with me for a couple days. I think that's October 20 to 23, something like that. So it's always free to come with the travel group. You know, I'm happy to share whatever knowledge I have and just shoot with you. It's fun. So anyway, got a bunch of shoots looking forward to and hoping to get some fall color like you've had.
Oh, it's great. Once you're out there and you start to see those first images pop up on your LCD screen, it makes it all worth it. Like I said, 1,600 miles of driving. I came back, no regrets whatsoever.
Well, that's awesome. Well, let's get talking about today's topic. Today we're going to talk about, well, here's the thing. We have 13 tips to share with you, but I think it's going to end up being a lot more like 20. Well, I'm planning for Iceland that we're going on with the travel group. And it's going to be a big group. I think we're going to have about 20 people from 5 different countries who are all, we're all converging on Iceland. One from Australia, UK, Canada, the US, and Iceland. And I think there's one coming from Norway as well. Anyway, people from all over the world, listeners of Improved Photography, we are converging on Iceland on November 10th. And so I've been trying to plan out an itinerary for us so that we can maximize our shooting time and not just spend the whole time in the car. So one cool landscape photography tip that I have is when you're planning a trip, you know, look for all your photo locations. Look on Flickr, look for tagged photos, you know, just Google search for photo locations and you'll get a bunch. But then if you go to Google Maps, not the normal Google Maps, but search just Google My Places Google Maps. That's the easiest way to find it. And then it allows you to create your own map and have all your waypoints on there. And by doing that, I just chart all of the cool locations I find in Iceland. And then I can see right on the map where they all are. So I say, oh, these 4 places are close to each other. And then we're going to plan that in one morning. So I'm using the My Google Maps for that. And it's really helpful for when you're planning a trip.
Awesome. I'll go ahead and include that in the show notes because that would have helped me out a lot. I went a little bit old-fashioned, and when I was out in Colorado, I just decided just to ask some locals and just try to find the ones that weren't annoyed by tourists and just be really nice and humble and say, hey, where can I find some really cool shots that no one else would really have? And they would lead you to areas, and luckily they were safe areas, and they would lead me and they'd say, okay, go here. This is a really neat spot. Here's the money shot that everyone else is going to have, but also here's the shot that is going to be a lot more unique if you can pull it off. So.
Yeah, very cool. One other tip for landscape photography is to not get lazy with your compositions. This is one I fall victim to all the time. Sometimes you're out shooting, you shoot a location, and once you feel like you got the shot, it's tough to keep shooting and changing that composition. I was just looking this morning through some photos that I took in Arizona at the Antelope Canyon, that's, you know, very popular, the Red Rock Canyons, and a beautiful location. As I shot a ton of different compositions, like 1,000 photos in the canyon, and it's just tough to tell what the winner is when you're on location. You're looking at a small LCD, you're in the moment, and it's hard to separate what you saw and what the camera saw. So, you know, you're just looking at the LCD, did this transfer into a picture? And so sometimes you get it, and it was just driving me crazy this morning as I was looking through my pictures, that the one that is the money shot, like I saw that one, I'm like, yes, that's what the trip's about. I just wasn't real careful, and I cut off the bottom of the picture, and it's just kind of a little bit of an awkward crop. I mean, if I would have moved that camera down just a couple millimeters, that would definitely have been the money shot, but I was a little bit lazy. I just shot it and moved on instead of going slow and paying close attention, and I really missed the best shot of the day by just not being quite perfect on the composition. So when you're out shooting landscapes, go slow and really think about every little square inch of the frame and use each part of it.
Yes, it's best to do that, and also just to take the time just to walk around, as you said in the past, and think about the shot. If you can just close your eyes and picture it after looking at it and figure out what type of shot that you want to get, then I would apply your technique of making sure just to take multiple shots, just because I would hate to get home and look at it on my computer and be like, gosh, I'm off a millimeter. Why didn't I just take one more shot from a different angle just to see how it turned out? So that's one thing that I did. I was walking around the lake in Aspen, and all these other photographers, they were just letting their shutter fly. I think they were on high continuous burst with their cameras, just boom, 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 boom. And I did shoot a lot of photos, don't get me wrong, but I walked around for 15, 20 minutes in some areas and just thought about which angles to do, which way to set up my tripod. And I just kept getting questioned, why aren't you shooting photos? You're out here just appreciating with your eyes. Yes, I was as well. But in the same time, you have to think about where you're carefully placing things in the photo to tell a story, because if you can't get that story across, it's just going to look like a snapshot.
That's a very good point. Another tip that can really help you is to dress warm and dress appropriately for the area. I hope this doesn't sound like just a kind of an obvious tip that we want to just throw in there. It's really very important when you're shooting landscapes. I can't count the number of times where it was a cold morning and, you know, you get there before sunrise, and for whatever reason, that particular location, especially in the mountains, you kind of want to wait for the sun to be a little bit higher than normal, you know, for the sun to go over the horizon so it lights up this canyon, something like that. And sometimes, you know, you can be waiting an hour. You found your composition, you're ready to go, but it could be an hour until the light's just right coming over the mountain. And so dress warmer than you think you're going to need to, because many, many times I've stood there waiting for the sun to come up and I'm like, okay, maybe it's not going to be that great. I'm cold, whatever, I'm going. And so, you know, you just kind of got the half shot and didn't wait all the time for the light. But it wasn't because you didn't want the shots, because you were uncomfortable. It was really cold outside. So, you know, get your warm clothes on. Make sure to have rain gear if you need it. One thing that I'm investing in right now is a doodad that I've shared before. It's called the Click Sit. It's just this very, very tiny little camp chair, but I mean, we're talking really tiny, that you can just fold up and sit and chuck in your photo bag. And then when you are waiting for the light, you have somewhere to sit and relax and be comfortable. And just that little bit of extra patience can really impact your photos quite a bit.
And when you were talking about that, I had to start laughing, because I remember that video. If you go to the Improved Photography website and take a look at your tutorial on how to shoot the Milky Way, you were standing outside somewhere in Idaho, miles away from civilization, and you were wearing a t-shirt, I believe, and I just had to laugh because you were just shivering as you're shooting the video. So as you're saying, dress warm, it's definitely something that you've experienced and I've experienced before as well, when I just underdressed for the weather. So one thing that I do is I make sure that I wear wool socks, because wool is just an amazing fabric to where even if it gets wet, it'll stay warm compared to cotton. And then also a lot of my gear that I bring to stay nimble, because yes, you can bring maybe four or five pairs of jeans, but it's going to weigh you down. I try to find stuff that's marked as being quick dry. That way you can hang it over a towel rack at your hotel room. If there's a hair dryer in there, if you're lucky enough, you can dry it off or put it in front of the vent in your car or something. But just try to stay nimble and stay wise about what you're wearing when you're out in the elements, because it's sometimes better to leave some stuff in your vehicle that'll keep you warm versus go out there and freeze and possibly, you know, endanger yourself.
Yeah, that's a good point. And what I did on that day, not only was I trying to hurry out of the house because I was late and I was worried I was gonna get there too late and the sun would start rising, but I grabbed my wife's jacket out of the closet because it was dark. And my wife is tiny, you know, there's no chance I'm going to fit into her jacket. This kind of things happens when you don't plan very well.
Yes, I agree. And then also, one thing I did notice as well is bring a lightweight tripod. What I did when I brought my tripod was I found there were situations where I wanted to use my tripod and my monopod. And when using the tripod, I would use it for stacking a couple neutral density filters on my camera, which allows you to have a slower shutter speed and get that nice, silky, wispy water when shooting rivers and whatnot. But also, if you bring a monopod in the same token, you can also use it as kind of a pseudo walking stick. I wouldn't put your whole weight on it, especially if you're a bigger guy like me, but it helps have balance and it helps you kind of have peace of mind as you're holding an expensive camera in your hands and maybe a gear bag that's full of other things that you would find precious to you. So I think that's going to help out in a lot of respects to bring a tripod, because you know, you might not have the lighting or the ability to hold the camera still without camera shake, and gosh, I would just hate to get out to a location and have blurry photos just because that one piece of gear was left behind.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is bring a tripod. If you can, I mean, bring a tripod, make sure it's light, and that you can carry it. If it's too heavy, you know, you're just not going to bring it. Now, if you can pay the money to buy a tripod that's light and sturdy, you know, do that. That's going to be that much better. But most importantly, just bring a tripod. You're going to want it. I used to leave my tripod home a lot when I had a very sturdy tripod, but a tripod that was just too heavy. I found myself just not wanting to take it with me. And so, yeah, I had exactly that problem. And then I bought a very nice lightweight tripod, and now it's easy to take on. I can just strap it right on the bag. It doesn't bang around as much when I'm walking around on the bag, and it's been great ever since.
It's a very useful tool, and also is you have to kind of plan out where you're going. So I try to make a bucket list, which I think would be the next tip. And where do you think that you would like to shoot, Jim?
I have a bucket list. In fact, I'll link to it. I'll link to my Google Doc that's just my photography bucket list. And I mentioned already how I find the photos for my bucket list. But anytime I find a photo in a location, I always save it to my bucket list of just locations. It doesn't mean that I like that particular photo. It doesn't mean that I want to, you know, use that exact same composition. It just means that I see something about that landscape that's cool and I want to go back there. So I think having a bucket list is definitely important. I have one that shows close locations and locations around the world where I want to go. And so, you know, if I'm getting bored of doing stuff and I say, okay, I really need to get out there and get shooting, I can look at my bucket list, grab one, and book a trip. You know, even if it means on Saturday I'm going to wake up at 2 a.m. and I'm going to drive to this cool location that's within 8 hours, then that's what I'm going to do. And sometimes I get to fly and, you know, make a real trip of it too. But don't make an excuse that my city is boring. You know, what's within 6 or 8 hours of your city? Then plan just a Friday and Saturday night, go drive out there, sleep in your car, and go shoot in the morning, or stay in a hotel for one night. You know, it doesn't have to be a huge expense. And in fact, if I drive to a photo location, I earn money. It doesn't cost me anything, because in at least the United States, we get paid 56.5 cents for every mile you drive. And wear and tear on a car is not 56.5 cents per mile. It's usually around, well, for my car, it's a great commuter car, gets really good gas mileage. So, you know, maybe cost me 25, maybe 30 cents a mile, even including depreciation on the car. So I make money every time I go. And so if I drive all day, I can stay in a hotel and it really doesn't cost me anything because I save that amount on taxes. So don't make excuses about, you know, my city's boring, I don't have anything interesting to shoot. You know, start doing some real looking around what's 6 or 8 hours away that you could make a Friday, Saturday trip of.
Yeah, and in my area, there's this movie that's it's real sappy. It's called Bridges of Madison County, and if you look on Google for Bridges of Madison County, there are some great shots there, and it's only a couple hour drive from me, and that's just on my bucket list too. And to keep shooting with that theme of the fall colors, I just want to head out there and have a great shot that incorporates the water and the colors and the bridges, which I haven't really found one lately. So there's not really an excuse. It's a 2 hour drive. We can sleep in the car and rough it, or stay in a cheap hotel or a motel. It doesn't matter. You just have to get out there and shoot and stay passionate about it, because to me, it's almost like riding a bike. The more practice you have, the better.
Yeah, and some of the locations may not be terribly interesting all times of the year, but if you're really looking and you have a good bucket list, you'll find some amazing places that are really close to you. An example of that is right now it's fall in the United States and in the Northern Hemisphere, and so find a tree farm. Tree farms are pretty boring during summer. It's just a lot of trees in a line, but every state, no matter where you are, there's going to be a tree farm somewhere within 6 hours of you. You might have to look around, but there's going to be one. And so find those tree farms, because they're going to be insanely beautiful this time of year. I mean, it's just hundreds, thousands of trees in perfect lines of all perfect fall color. Like, have you found a better location ever for a portrait shoot? That's awesome. So I'm going to a tree farm probably next week to shoot, just because they're really beautiful in the fall. So don't overlook places that are close to home that you can really, if you really think about it, you are actually pretty cool.
Yeah, and also it's just really neat as well, because they're going back to one of the most famous landscape photographers out there, Ansel Adams. He was one of the first to work with weather and landscapes together, and now it's actually a requirement. And just the nuances of weather and the way it changes, you can incorporate it and keep the photo interesting, and then you can also think about it a little bit differently and try to cut things out, especially if they're taking away from the photo. A lot of photos people will send me for reviews and photo critiques, they'll say, hey, check this photo out, and it's this gorgeous landscape shot, but I just have this big blue sky with not even a single cloud, and it's boring. And then I also will see, you know, a bright blob of sunlight in the middle of the photo. So that's my take on it as well, is work with the weather, appreciate the weather, and see if it adds or deters from your photo as far as telling the story.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Ansel Adams is famous mostly because he was way ahead of his time. He did great works. They're fantastic. You know, great works, but the most important thing is he was way ahead of his time. He was doing things in landscape photography that nobody was doing at that time. For example, he was hunting that weather and how the weather interacted with the landscape, like you mentioned. And now everybody's doing that. You know, you can't take a landscape without the weather. The weather is part of the landscape. That's just the status of how we think about landscape photography today. So it really is important to pay attention not only to the place itself and if it's interesting, but is there interesting weather? Is there interesting fog in the fall where it's cold and there's a little pond next to your house that's, you know, kind of a boring place normally, but what if there's a beautiful fog over the pond? You got to really think about it that way. All right, the next tip is when shooting sunrise. Now, I've mentioned many times on the podcast that I love being at a location while it's black, waiting for the sun to rise, because often the best color is before the sun ever hits the horizon. But a lot of times you do want to include the actual sun in the landscape, you know, in that half hour, hour after sunrise while the sun is still coming up. And the technique that I always do when the sun is above the horizon, the problem is the sun is so bright that it washes everything else out. No matter what you do, it just washes everything else out. So what I often do is I find ways to cut the sun. You may get a leaf in a tree. We're talking a lot about fall color. You may use a leaf in a tree and have it just cover part of the sun. Wait for a cloud to cover part of the sun. Use a rock and have the sun flare peeking around the rock. Find ways to cut that sun, because then you're cutting down the brightness of the sun as well, and it evens out the composition, evens out the brightness level throughout the composition a lot more. So when the sun's above the horizon, cut it.
That's a great technique. I really haven't put much into practice with that. I actually have been cheating and been using you know, HDR and auto exposure bracketing, and I keep pulling it into Photoshop or other HDR programs and realizing it's still this bright blob in there. So yeah, blocking it out would be a great thing to do. And even if you're in a urban landscape or area where you're trying to do some urban shots with architecture, try to see if part of the building can cut out the sun, especially if you have all these beautiful colors behind skyscrapers or an old historic district in a smaller town. I think that that's great advice.
Yeah, and speaking of bracketing, what I often find myself falling victim to is when I see a very high dynamic range where I think, okay, I'm going to actually, you know, do some auto exposure bracketing, is I get way too bracket happy. And then everything I shoot for the next 30 minutes is a nine-stop bracket. And then you bring it in into the computer and I look at it and it's like just tons of pictures. And it's just, I tend to spray and pray when I flip into auto exposure bracketing mode. What I've found so much recently, you know, ever since I switched to the D800 really, is there's so much detail in that raw file that it's really rare that I find that I really do need to bracket a scene. And almost every time, even if I do want to do HDR, which is becoming less and less common for me, I'm just not bracketing it. I'm just shooting one properly exposed raw file, and then in software, I'm increasing the exposure, decreasing the exposure, and using those frames to do the HDR processing. So don't get bracket happy, and the same goes for pano happy. When I shoot a pano, I have a tendency to stop thinking about composition. You're like, okay, panorama time. I'm going to shoot like 14 shots across here, couple up on the next row, and it just ends up being this flood of photos. When you're shooting a panorama, you still have to think about your composition. Just you have to think about it across two or three photos. Often I see that I think, okay, I'm just going to go too wide and too high with this panorama, and then I'll crop it in later. And it ends up just never working. So even if you're shooting a panorama with, you know, three files or so, still think very carefully about your composition.
And I have to agree with the bracketing and being bracket happy as well too, because as the cameras advance, there's so much dynamic range that you can pull out of that raw file. Like there was a church I was shooting the inside of a church in, I believe it was Lyon, France in the spring. And I showed it to my buddy after I edited it only in Lightroom. And he said, was that an HDR shot? And I said, no, I just edited it quickly in Lightroom, messed around with certain settings, and it almost looked like an HDR shot without actually having the time to take the HDR shot, stitch the files together, and end up with a large TIFF file on my computer taking up a bunch of space. So I was really satisfied with that. And I'm also using auto exposure bracketing and HDR a little bit less. I went through a little phase where I was gung-ho about it, but as dynamic range just keeps increasing in these cameras, why not just use the single exposure and see the amazing photos that can come out of just one single raw file?
Very good point. Another tip when you're out shooting landscapes is that sometimes you really do need to get off the pavement and off the beaten path and be willing to really get out there to do something different. I see this so often when I go to, you know, famous places to shoot. When you're in Banff and there's, you know, this turnout where all the cars park and everybody shoots there, or really any famous photo location that, you know, you kind of stick to the spot. And I think what's fun about landscape photography is, you know, you want to get the shot, but you want to get the shot that your mind went into, your creativity went into. Now, that's fun because it personalizes the photos to you and makes you like it more. But also, you're going to like the photos more because it's just your style. When you go out away from the obvious spot and find a different way to look at something. Most often when I do that, when I try to find something different from the normal composition, I like it more because it's my style. You know, what other people think, I don't know. But it's more fun because I know I created it in my mind.
And it's more personable. A lot of people, when you take the time just to walk out there, especially if you're in a foresty area or wooded area, it just gives you time to clear your mind and you look around and you just see what's beautiful and even go off the beaten path if you're on a trail. Like there's this area walking into the Aspens I just that's what really kind of just drove me to actually drive across the state of Nebraska and into Colorado, was looking at those shots that I've seen before that people are shooting in the middle of the aspens. But what I also noticed, there wasn't really anything included in the foreground is an added interest. And that's something that I love to do with my landscape shots, is not only have something in the background that's really interesting to look at, but something interesting in the foreground. So I hiked in really deep, probably in an area where I might not have supposed to have been, but still I pulled off an amazing shot and my style shined through. And then people who look at your photos, they'll notice that that passion's in there and your style shines through as well. So I think that's kind of a responsibility of photographers, is to develop a style as well, because I kind of, this is a little bit of a rat hole, but I kind of got in a debate with people about watermarking and whatnot. And I said, well, you know, anyone can really take the same shot as anyone else if they'd like to, but kind of the responsibility falls on the photographer to some degree to develop a style. Because once, you know, if we pull out a photo and we say, okay, here's a photo, this is a Lindsay Adler photo. Well, you know, if someone takes an identical one, someone's going to say, that looks like a Lindsay Adler photo, that looks like a Dave Black photo, a Michael Fry photo, a Jim Harmer photo. It's part of our responsibility to develop that style and have it shine through with our work. And that's why I'm just kind of against over watermarking my photos and trying to keep them clean.
Very good point.
Yeah, sorry to go down that rat hole, but another thing as well when it comes to photographers is respect other photographers as well. Like, I mean, they're out there trying to do what you're doing as well. So mainly what I like to do is talk to the photographers and say, hey, you know, am I walking in front of your shot? Like, I was chatting with someone as I was walking back to my car exhausted after shooting on Monday morning, and I said, are you in the middle of a shot? And she said no, and she just kind of, you know, bowed to me real nicely and was just very appreciative of that. And then also listening to the park rangers, because they're really willing to give you some cool tips. I was able to walk up to some as I had my tripod over my shoulder and my monopod in my backpack, and I said, well, where can I go to get shots? And one photographer said, well, here's the area where the money shot is that everyone else has, but if you just take the time to hike in a little bit, I'll tell you. And he kind of said, turn left here, turn right here, and go down this path. And he actually showed me some areas where not very many people trek in, and he noticed that, you know, I was dressed for it and able to pull off the shots. And just make sure that you're respecting people who you're around as well as the nature. I think that we get caught up in the photo, and sometimes we don't pay attention to who's around us and whether or not we're impacting their experience as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's something I've done as well when I went to Yellowstone, is go to the visitor center and say, hey, can I talk to a biologist? And the biologists spend most of their time out alone in the forest or in their office study, you know, looking at numbers all day. And so every time I've done that, they've been so happy to talk to me. You know, I explain what I'm doing and why I'm there, say I'm really interested in the gray wolves and this is what I want to shoot. And they are just a wealth of information. I mean, it's obviously what they do all day is, you know, track the wolves or track the elk or whatnot. So go to the visitor center if you're in a place like that and say, I want to talk to a biologist, and they really know some cool stuff.
They do, and they're so excited to talk about it, because not very many people take the time to have a conversation with them, and they'll inform you of some things that you would have never even guessed.
Mm-hmm. And they can also talk you out of some of the places, you know. I've done before when I have gone to places to a national park or something, I'll show the visitor center or a biologist, one of the forest rangers, I'll say, hey, these are the locations I'm thinking about shooting. You know, do you know anything about these spots? And many times I've had them, oh, cross that one off, the road's closed there. Oh, thank you. That saves me a whole, you know, where you're planning to go there for sunrise, you drive in on this dirt road and then the road's closed the rest of the way. Then you lost your whole sunrise shoot. So spending a little bit of time when it's not peak hours, you know, during the middle of the day, head over to the visitor center and ask that kind of thing. I can't tell you how many times they've saved my shoot, but where they've told me places, don't go here, don't go there. You know, oh, actually the leaves have all fallen off the tree up there. That's a lot higher than we are right now. So it's some pretty good tips from them.
Oh, for sure. And they'll even check, and they'll, like, one time, actually this last time when I was driving to the visitor center, he was telling me that make sure that you have water in your car just in case you get stranded up here, because we're not sure what the weather is going to be like. Bring some granola bars, which I was kind of a Boy Scout growing up. I didn't make it all the way through to Eagle Scouts, but as a Boy Scout, I learned to be prepared, and I have granola bars in my car all the time, extra water, things like that, even a candle to heat up some snow if it happened to be trapped. But it's really really nice to talk to the rangers, and also they'll let you know what you need to have. Like, he even steered me away, not because of a road that was inaccessible, but he said, "Do you have a bear canister with you?" And I had no idea what a bear canister was, but out by Crater Lake, they've been seeing lots of black bears. And he said, "I wouldn't really go deep into the woods there unless you have something to protect yourself with." So he did steer me away from one area, but he also pointed me in the direction of another area where I could get some amazing shots.
Yeah, every single year, a few photographers die from getting too close to bears. Happens every year. It happens. So you got to be careful. We have a lot of bear spray in our house. In fact, I put it on in my wife's bedstand for when I'm gone. We don't do the little tiny pepper spray. I saw a demonstration once. This is getting random. Where they shot one of those little, you know, women's pepper sprays that they keep in their purse. It goes about 2, maybe 3 feet. I guess that's a meter. That's it. So somebody's got to be like pummeling you at that moment, and keep their eyes open for it to do anything. Bear spray is in a little bit of a taller can, but you know, it still fits in a purse or something. And or I clip it on my belt when I'm out hiking. And it's like a fire extinguisher. Anything within 25 feet is going to be covered in pepper spray. So there is a big difference between bear spray and regular pepper spray, even though the active ingredient is the same thing. So I think that's very important when you're out. If you're in bear country, really, you're going to want to have it. I've been charged by a bear before, and it was not that just me getting close. I was just coming up over a little bit of a hill, and I had no idea there was a bear there. And sure enough, I was just, you know, a few paces away from a bear cub. And where bear cubs are, mama is not far behind. And she was not too happy when she saw me just a couple steps away from this cub that I had no idea was in the bush just over the hill. So you never know what's going to happen. Just get a can of bear spray and have it with you. It's can definitely save your life. Speaking of safety tips, you know, tell somebody where you're going to be. I go out and do a lot of photography on my own, and you always want to make sure you have a clear plan of where you are, especially if there's no self-service. But if there is self-service in the area you're going, you can often wear down your phone really quick if you have your phone and, you know, with Wi-Fi and data turned on and everything. So turn it on into airplane mode if you're going to run out of battery while you're out. And another thing that I do is I have an Anker. It's Anker is the brand, and it's an external battery pack for your cell phone. They make them for any cell phone brand, and it's just an extra battery that you can just plug in your cord and charge your phone once it runs dead. So if you have a small phone battery and it's not going to last you through an entire day when you're out in the woods, out far from the city, then that's a great way to make sure that you have a cell phone and a lifeline if you're going to be within cell reception.
Yeah, and it's amazing because they can also use your GPS location if you have to turn it on sporadically to try to find you and see if there's any GPS pings coming off your phone. And one thing I noticed, and it might have been a fluke, but in the middle of a national park in Colorado, my phone was picking up Wi-Fi. I had it on airplane mode, but Wi-Fi's optional, and it tried to connect to something. So maybe they're starting to put hidden Wi-Fi little receivers on the trees. I didn't see any, but my phone definitely picked one up. But like I said, it's great to have it's great to have the airplane mode on there. And I always carry around a little 5,000 milliamp external battery. All you have to do is plug a USB cord in, and as long as your connector goes to your phone, it gets you that extra battery life that might come in handy in a real dangerous situation.
Very good. Well, there's so much about landscape photography that we could talk about. I think we could do another 5 or 6 podcasts about landscapes and just scratch the surface. But in every episode, we want to share a doodad, a something that we've found recently that we want to share with you. And we've already mentioned quite a few different products. But Darren, what do you have for us today?
Well, talking about is how prepared I was. I was actually a little bit unprepared. I was wearing some ASICS running shoes out in the mountains, and I noticed before we even got close to Aspen that just the dew on the grass was soaking through and already getting my socks wet. And there was, I think Michael Fry was on the show about 6 to 8 months ago, and he was talking about the importance of having great shoes for landscaping or landscape photographers. And I didn't listen to that until I got to Aspen, and my doodad of the week is actually the Salomon Quest 4D GX shoes or hiking boots, and they're a full hiking boot where they protect your whole ankle. They have a hard rubberized toe. It's almost like having a steel toe. The bottom is very, very sturdy as far as how thick the rubber is, because my dad has a similar pair of Asics as I did. And in another situation, he actually was in Arizona and had a saguaro cactus needle almost go completely through his shoe, but there's no way it's going to go through this thick rubber. And another cool thing about these shoes is they're completely Gore-Tex waterproof, so they're breathable, but they're waterproof. And so there are situations, and I was out there photographing the Maroon Bells, which are the famous mountains near Aspen, Colorado, and people were looking at me so strange because I didn't have waders or gaiters or anything like that or on my feet, and I was standing in the water with my pant legs rolled up, and they just said, "Is that water cold?" And I said, "No, I can't really feel it at all. It's, you know, my feet are dry." And they said, "Oh, you must have waterproof boots." So I think it's very important, not if you don't, it does not just applicable if you're going to stand in streams or stand in lakes to take photos, but have a really sturdy pair of shoes. And that's why I definitely think that these Salomon hiking boots are amazing. So what do you usually wear when you're out there, Jim? Or are you looking at these now that I've talked about them? Or
yeah, actually, we were laughing when we before we started recording, we were asking what doodad we were going to share, and you said that, and literally yesterday I put a pair of these boots in my Amazon wish list, because I'm shopping for Iceland, getting everything ready, and I wanted some boots that'll stay warm, but I don't know, I'm not like a big heavy boot guy, that's just not my thing, but I wanted something really warm, and so those looked good. So yeah, I'm definitely looking at those. And not to make this a fashion episode, but I'm going to share two other pieces of clothing as my doodads of the week. Am I allowed to have two doodads? I hope so, because I am. It is first the Blackhawk Tactical Pants. Now, these are pants that, you know, cops, EMTs, that kind of people will wear, and that's what they're most often sold for. But they are awesome for landscape photography. They have a ton of pockets, and they make them for men and women. They have a ton of pockets, so you can put your filters and all your stuff in it, and you don't need a photo vest. You don't have to look like that. They have tons of space to put stuff. They have double material on the seat and the knees, so you know they'll wear nicely. And they're not waterproof, but they're very water resistant. So if you know, if there's dew that you're kneeling in, sitting in, it's gonna be just fine. If it rains, it's gonna run right off. And one thing that I really like is you can insert a foam knee pad in it. So on the inside of the pants, you can insert a little foam knee pad that they sell separately. And it's so nice when you're shooting landscapes where, I don't know, maybe 80% of my landscapes are waist height or lower, my tripod height. So I'm usually on my knees when I'm shooting landscape photography. And so to have that knee pad is so nice where you're on gravel or rock, something like that. It really makes shooting landscapes a lot more comfortable. Again, that's another area where I've seen that sometimes I get lazy when I'm shooting because I'm uncomfortable. And so I don't lay down on the ground to see what the photo looks through the viewfinder. I just kind of fudge it and think what it's going to look like. So those Blackhawk Tactical Pants, I think, are really cool. And the other thing that I want to share is Outdoor Research three-finger gloves. It is getting cold in a lot of the world, and these gloves are really, really warm. You kind of look like a Ninja Turtle with three fingers, but what it does is it puts your pinky, your ring finger, and your middle finger in kind of a mitten and keeps your index finger and your thumb loose. So it's still going to be tough to operate the camera with these gloves on. I mean, these are full snow gloves. But what I'm planning on doing is using a liner. So I have gloves that I can, you know, easily maneuver my fingers in. And then I can slip out my hand and my glove in the glove liner to keep it still kind of warm to maneuver the camera. But I've never found one of those, you know, mittens that you rip, that you pull back and have your fingers loose. Every time I use those, my fingers are always cold. Because of that seam and because, you know, your fingers are exposed for part of it. So that's what I'm switching to for this winter, and I think it's going to be a lot more comfortable. So those Outdoor Research three-finger gloves if you're going to be out in extreme weather.
Gosh, I wish I would have known about those pants this weekend. As you were talking about, I was reaching down and I was feeling my kneecaps that are bruised because I did get down on the ground on rocky surfaces and things like that, and my knees are just bruised to heck. But now that I know about these, I'm just excited because I thought to myself, gosh, I should have brought my old rollerblade knee pads with me just because it was killing me by the end of the day. But that's awesome.
Yeah, and a lot of especially sports photographers, but also landscape photographers do wear like full knee pads. And I've never done that just because I feel kind of silly walking around in knee pads. And it's uncomfortable if you're going very far to walk in knee pads. But these are nice. It's just normal pants and you slip that little foam knee pad in there. Very, very nice.
Awesome. That sounds really wonderful.
Well, it's been a great episode. I love talking about landscapes, especially because I'm going to be getting out and shooting a lot over the next few weeks. The Lens Finder project, just to give you an update, I was really hoping to have it out by October 1st, but I want to make sure this project is flawless when it comes out. And so I've invested in some developers doing some work for me to make it look great and work perfectly. So you're going to have to give me another couple weeks, but it's going to be awesome when it's out. Thanks, everybody. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, and I've had a sneak peek at it, and it looks awesome, and I'm not just partial to it. I just wish that I would have had a tool like this when I was looking for some of my lenses, so I'm excited. I'm thrilled to see what it's going to look like with the finished result.
Cool. All right, thanks, everybody, for the download. I appreciate your support of the podcast, and we will catch you in another week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.